You're listening to Bible Prophecy Daily, a weekday podcast where Bible prophecy matters and matters greatly.
And it's another episode of Bible Prophecy Daily. I'm your host this go-around, Jake McCandless of Stand Firm, through that ministry where I'm writing and speaking, doing all I can to help believers navigate such a time as this. And we're especially focusing on the next generation, the emerging generation, helping them stand firm and have a faith that lasts. Well, today in this episode, I'm going to talk about my recent trip to Israel. I hope you caught my previous episode where I talked about why I went. So I just returned just a little less than a week ago. I hope to drop several episodes from that experience over the next couple of months, because we had the chance while we were there to tour the sites of the October 7th attack massacre. We had the chance to speak with survivors, family of those who had been taken hostage, family of those who were killed. Had the chance to see things firsthand, get to speak with officials. We really had a 360-degree view of the attacks. As we toured a particular kibbutz there, we were given the tour by a survivor who remained in his safe room for 36 hours, at least the first 12 of that holding the latch to the safe room door. We had the chance to talk to parents of some that were killed there. Then we had the chance to listen to the what would be equivalent to our 911 tapes, their 101 tapes, both the dispatching and the calls that came in as we went to the National Ambulance Service. We get to hear firsthand from military officials about how it went down. A 360-degree view. I want to talk about that and share about some of those things that were seen and learned. But in particular today, I want to talk about what I believe is the most glaring question and objection to the attacks. And that's, how did Israel not know? I'm sure you've heard that from the get-go, as the media's talked about it. Israel has one of the most sophisticated intelligence infrastructures, and Hamas isn't the most sophisticated group. So how did Israel not know? As I was preparing for the trip, this was the question I knew I was going to ask officials if I had the chance. It was what I thought would be the most controversial conversation that we would have. It's something I thought, you know, if I got any answers, I would have to drag out of everyone. Surprisingly, it was one of the first things offered to us in, I believe, every visit, in every conversation. Whether that was a survivor from the attack in the kibbutz, someone who was displaced, a messianic leader, our military official. It was readily offered. And the reality was really shocking to me. And that's why I wanted to take some time to talk about that. Because I really believe it's one of the hurdles for... I mean, listen, we've got people in the media saying it didn't happen. You know, and they've done this with the Holocaust, saying it didn't happen. They're, you know, remove it from history books. Listen, it happened. I walked through a kibbutz that was attacked. I walked through their weapons, their arsenal room that was first attacked. And Hamas hid out and waited for the security team to come and shot them up, ambushed them. I went into homes where children were killed, where whole families were killed. Families circled up, arms around each other, all killed. Homes where children survived, hiding in a cabinet, but the parents were killed. Homes where hostages were taken. Homes of a young couple, 20-something year old couple, the house absolutely just shot up. I had the chance to go down the road where the cars were burnt at the Nova Music Festival. Chance to walk through the Nova Music Festival, seeing the bomb shelter and bathrooms that you saw in the Hamas footage. Walking through the trees where they tried to take cover, the open field where they tried to run. Heard from survivors of that. Friends of those who were killed. Stood next to just a mountain of burnt cars from the attacks. It happened. And we shouldn't be debating it. Hamas themselves filmed it, and we've seen the evidence. But yet, people doubt it's real. And I want to make sure this gets said, because I'll get wrapped up in what I had planned to say and not say this, but in every interview that I had the chance to say anything, I would reply and ask, okay, what is it that you want us to take back from this? And to a person, it was always, please just tell the truth. I was actually shocked at how little, like, these conversations where those there in Israel tried to sensationalize what happened. I mean, they didn't try to even go to the really gory, horrific details. They just wanted it known. It happened. We were attacked. Okay, but the question, again, I think for those who, yeah, we know it was an attack. We know it was terrible. We know Hamas is terrible. We know that. But how in the world did this happen? Now, ultimately, of course, I don't have that answer from the top end of government. But I do have an unfolding of a consistent story, again, from a survivor in a kibbutz, displaced from the south and the north, military officials we did talk to, and it was all the same. No one ever doubted that they didn't know. No one doubted there weren't signs. But they all talked about those signs, that evidence was ignored. To me, it was mind-boggling. I mean, Hamas has been shooting rockets at Israel for over 20 years. You know, since 2016, they've had the Red Alert app. Some of you, I think, probably have it, and you keep up with what's going on. I mean, just today as I'm preparing it, I forgot to turn off the notifications, and I'm just seeing all the rockets being shot, mostly in the north now. But Hamas had done this for over 20-something years. 2016, it became just normal. You see your town. If you're close to Gaza, you got 15 seconds to take cover. If you're further away in Jerusalem, maybe you got 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes to take cover. Spend a little time in your safe room. This is a normal part of the day. I mean, come on. Like, how can you not see something like this coming is my thoughts. Numerous conversations. I want to be careful with outright identities. I'll probably screw that up. So I hope I can catch it in my post edits here. But out of those conversations, one of them, an undisclosed messianic leader we talked with, said they knew. The government knew. They even had the strategy. There were signs of things being ramped up, Gaza and the West Bank, but they didn't believe Hamas would do it. And this is the same tale we got over and over. Just maybe a little more details each time. Again, a survivor in the kibbutz, a mile and a half from Gaza. He worked side by side with Gazans. He was shocked that they did this. So over the last, I don't know quite the time frame, but Israel had gotten up to nearly 20,000 work permits, allowing for those in Gaza to come over and work. They were making a good wage. It was, you know, theoretically should have been helping their standard of living there in Gaza. The survivor in the kibbutz, it wasn't even just about the work. He talked about how they would try to get kids over from Gaza to celebrate in activities there in the kibbutz, there in that town. Worked side by side, and in a sense lived side by side by those in Gaza. Even though rockets were coming over, felt like he saw the humanity that Israel was doing a lot of good towards Gaza. Again, working side by side. Yet those that came over to work, for the most part, and especially in this kibbutz, they were just getting scouting details. They were looking where the ambulance was parked. So one of the first targets could be shoot out the tires, shoot it up, wait for the EMT to come out when he gets the emergency call. Where the weapons were stored so they could go take that, wait for the security team to come, and ambush them. This man who had worked side by side, who had helped kids from Gaza, sat in his safe room for 36 hours as Hamas sat in his, you know, in a sense, a living room, and they just shot up the town. I'm shocked. someone speaking, towns, kibbutz that were attacked near Gaza. Talked about in a sense also had a liberal view in the sense of, you know, if we do enough humanitarian aid, if we do enough good, then they'll live in peace with us. Military expert, had a role in Gaza intelligence, shared how Hezbollah released the very plans online 10 years ago. Made a video. Hezbollah made a video. This was the same plan, it just was in the north. Hamas followed it to a T. Another military expert talked about how the government was told, how they had documentation, how they had intel of movement. This was not talked about on the trip, but I recently have read about how that they recognized there was a large number of people in Gaza who switched their SIM cards to Israeli SIM cards. But these leaders said that it was just looked at as aspirational goals, not a real threat. Another military leader, one that is an architect of the security barrier of the fence. We'd met him in July. He designed the fence that surrounds all, you know, all the security barrier within Israel. You know, as he talks about what Hamas did, it's they blew up my fence. They bulldozed my fence. When we met him in July, he talked about how he just had bent over backwards meeting with Arab Muslims, whether that's in Gaza or the West Bank, our neighbors within Israel, how it was built to come down, that there would be peace. I mean, when we talked in July, there was such a hope for peace. And talking to him now, it was just a near shock that this would happen. Again, I can't speak what the official decision was in the upper echelons of the government, but it was shocking to hear over and over. Yeah, we knew. We saw, I mean, we can look back, there were signs, but we did not think they would do it. An article coming from West Point's combating terrorism site talked about the attack being planned in plain sight, yet overlooked and ignored. Again, it really shocking to me. Again, the things I heard over and over again was Israel, it felt like they had done so much good for Gaza. I mean, if you really follow the history of what Israel has done for Gaza, they have. They've bent over backwards. So again, to a person, everyone acknowledged, hey, there were signs. We should have known this. We could have known this. We knew it. Of course, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. But what had kept coming up was there had been steps towards peace. Israel had done so much good towards Gaza. And those goals were just aspirations. They wouldn't dare do that. And Israel had done so much good for Gaza. You're talking about bending over backwards. Go back to 2005. I mean, this territory in Gaza belongs to Israel. And we hear all these names thrown around, you know, Palestinians, you know, Hamas, all these things, different names. And I think it's hard to kind of come to grips with what's actually there. And so in Israel, the nation of Israel, there are different groups of people. You have Jews, and you have multi-facets of Jews. You have Arab Muslims. You have Druze. You have Christians. All live together. All citizens. All have representation in government. But in Gaza, we have Arab Muslims who do not want to live at peace as some other Arab Muslims do within the land of Israel. In the West Bank, there are Arab Muslims as well. So you have Arab Muslims and Jews living side by side within Israel. But then in these different areas, You have those who want to have just an Arab Muslim state with no Jews. Of course, the history goes way back, going back towards to the British Mandate. You have Egypt, who has control over Gaza to begin with. Israel gains that in the Six-Day War. But those Arab Muslims within the Gaza Strip have chosen to keep refugee status rather than becoming citizens of Israel. And there has been constant attacks. But even though the land belongs to Israel in 2005, all Israelis were pulled out. The land just given over to Arab Muslims. At the time, it was ruled, led by the Palestinian, by the PLO. In 2006, after all the Israelis pulled out, there was an election. Hamas won as a political party. And then they go on to physically remove their competition. And Hamas has stayed in power. There's not been an election since then. They have continually to be attacks. There's continual rocket fire. But still, Israel has allowed Hamas to keep authority in that land. They've continued to keep Israelis out. They've allowed over $40 billion in aid to come, some of that coming from Israel. Enough money has come through this little strip of land that it could have been another Dubai. But instead, it was a network of tunnels built for terror. You have the work permits. You just go on and on and on. Israel had just continued bent, appeased those in Gaza. I mean, for good grief, I mean, we can at least go back to 2016 where you have this app created for rocket alerts. And it's like, okay, we just understand this is just their thing. They're going to shoot rockets at us and we're just going to continue live in peace. Israel had done a lot. And many had thought they'd done enough. It also had been quite a while since the last outright attacks. And there had not been a concentrated attack like this before. And so within Israel, you have, I think some said it there, they called it liberal views. But I mean, it's really just taking a soft stance, an appeasement stance towards Gaza, towards Hamas, rather than a hard-lined stance, which they have now. I mean, but can you imagine any other country putting up with rockets for 20-something years? And there was deception on the part of Hamas to come in, for the Gazans to come in on these work permits, to work hand in hand the whole time, scouting out for this attack. They played the long game. But I think there's a couple other areas that explain how did this happen. And this was said by individuals within Israel. I'm not saying anything that wasn't said to me. But there was pride. Israel's got one of the strongest militaries in that region. Definitely one of the greatest intelligence agencies. They can stomp Hamas. Because when you break down these terrorist groups, Hamas is the bottom feeder. So there was pride. And one leader even said, as we know, pride comes before a fall. So I think you had this pride sense that were there. But the thing that was not mentioned, and I believe for us to understand this biblically, we have to realize there's ultimately a blindness. And I think to really understand Israel, even in today's world, we have to connect it to, okay, how did God interact with Israel in the Bible? And I say that, and I know some of you probably cringe when you hear that. And the thing is, probably all of us listening here, we're not replacement theologists. We know the church did not replace Israel. We know God's not done with Israel. But yet, when it comes to breaking down what's happening today and how God interacts with Israel, we still, in a sense, act like replacement theologists in the sense of, we're like, well, you know, they haven't accepted Jesus as Messiah, so therefore, they're not right with God. So therefore, you know, God's not working with them. But that's not the case. I mean, if we're going to hold and teach that, you know, God's going to keep his covenant with them regarding the land, then also the Mosaic covenant in terms of, hey, you'll be blessed in the land if you obey these commands, if you live this way, and you'll be cursed. And we can't say one part of that still exists and the other doesn't. And I think some of that's at play. And we have to realize ultimately all of this is spiritual. It's a spiritual conflict, and there is blindness. You know, when we go back in the Bible and even in modern times, we celebrate the miracles that have been done in battle and wars for Israel. I mean, there are so many instances in the Bible, but even modern day, where it's unexplained. I read one report from West Point from where they said, we do not study the Six Days War. We don't study the Israel's War of Independence because there's no explanation. The quote was, we teach strategy, not miracles. And a constant throughout Israel's history, biblically and modern times, it's obvious God's hand has been at work. And we see that in the success. But just as there have been surprise wins and miracles within battle, there's also been surprising losses where in history Israel should have won. Just as there have been confounding victories, there have been confounding losses. One conversation came up over and over, whether in the airport or there in Israel, and I would be asked, point blank, why does the world hate us? Why is the world against us? I would try to take it back to, there's a spiritual war. There's a spiritual battle. And that's not the first thing that's been thought about on the ground. So I wanted to spend the time in this episode talking about, to me, what is the most glaring question of the 10/7 attacks. But as always, we've got to be careful as we begin talking about just the political issues and military and those things. We can't be cold-hearted towards the actual humanity on the ground and on both sides. But I also believe we've got to bring this back to, there is a judgment. Joel 3 talks about the nations being judged, how they deal with Israel. However that works and however that looks like, as believers, we need to make sure that we are on God's side. And His side is standing with Israel.
Thanks for listening to Bible Prophecy Daily. We hope you learned something valuable today. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode.